National Trust Magazine, Summer 2026.
Hello and welcome to the summer issue of National Trust Magazine. I'm Sally Palmer, editor of the magazine, and I'll be taking you through some of the highlights, including news, features, and events to enjoy. What nicer way to enjoy summer sunshine than out in a garden, your own, one in trust care, or a local park or green space? Do take a moment to admire the magazine's glorious cover illustration by senior gardener Lizzie Pellow. It illustrates plans for the inspirational new Arcadia Forest Garden at Shugborough in Staffordshire. Across the country, gardens offer patchworks of resilience against the twin challenges of nature loss and climate change. Find out how trust garden teams are already adapting their planting and approach to lean into the challenges of the future in our feature, Rooting for Nature. Continuing the theme of future-proofing gardens, Trust Ambassador and presenter Mark Lane offers his suggestions for how to make gardens more accessible in our feature, On Common Ground. And we're helping you make the most of the season with fresh salad recipes, along with tips for even the smallest outdoor growing spaces, from Sky Gardening Challenge judge Jason Williams. Here's Tatia Newell, Akia Henry, and Glenn McCready to tell you about what's been happening around the Trust.
High flyers. This time last year, tiny seedlings began to unfurl across Greater Manchester as hundreds of people joined the National Trust's Sky Gardening Challenge. The challenge aims to encourage people living in flats to green their balconies and window boxes. And this year, it'll be going national. Budding gardeners can sign up to receive free seeds and a balcony gardening guide to help you get started and take part in gardening workshops sponsored by L&G. From June, there will be the chance to enter the challenges competition. Last year, Emily Bush won the one-pot power category. Her pot, intended for herbs, overflowed with seedlings from discarded fruit and vegetables secretly added by both her partner and her housemate. Find out more at nationaltrust.org.uk/sky-gardening-challenge.
Quiet Waters. Winston Churchill's painting Quiet Waters is on display for the first time in the UK at his former home of Chartwell in Kent. The wartime Prime Minister turned to art to find calm amidst the pressures of leadership, describing painting as something that came to my rescue. He gave Quiet Waters to his close friend Lord Beaverbrook for his 80th birthday in 1959. The Beaverbrook Canadian Foundation has loaned the painting to Chartwell, where it is now on display alongside some of Churchill's personal objects and art materials, including his paint-spattered overcoat, specially made by his tailors on Savile Row, and the still-framed spectacles he used while he was painting. Visit nationaltrust.org.uk/Chartwell.
A giant thank you. Standing proud above the Dorset village that bears his name, the Cerne Abbas giant contemplates his hillside home. At 55 metres, or 180 feet, from club tip to toe, he's the UK's largest chalk figure, and one of the most famous. He was probably first sculpted during the early medieval period, which makes him between 900 and 1,300 years old, but his identity and who carved him into the hillside is still a mystery. We've looked after the giant since 1920, thanks to your generosity following our recent appeal, alongside a host of grants, gifts and legacies, we've now also been able to bring an area the size of 190 football pitches surrounding him into trust care. Over the coming years, we'll care for his chalk grassland, create new habitats to support rare plants and animals, and improve visitor access so more people can explore his landscape. You can find out more at nationaltrust.org.uk/Cerne-giant-appeal.
Wildlife on the big screen. The Trust's popular Puffin Cam is returning this year with live footage of the UK's wildlife, and it's coming to a big screen near you. This summer, a giant screen on wheels will travel to cities around the UK, giving busy city dwellers, commuters and shoppers the chance to immerse themselves in the puffins' lives on the remote Farne Islands in Northumberland. Some 43,000 pairs of puffins journey to the Farnes each year to breed and raise their chicks. There are more screenings planned for the autumn, so stay tuned.
Beaver breakthrough. This spring, the Trust released three pairs and a family of four Eurasian beavers into the wild at the Hunnicutt Estate on Exmoor in Somerset. The release marked an important milestone in an ambitious project to restore rivers and wetlands. As well as creating dams, beavers dig channels and ponds, which help reduce erosion, improve water quality, and retain water where it's needed. Their return is part of a wider programme to reintroduce them with other key species, including white-tailed eagles and pine martens. It was our second wild release of beavers since a major policy shift was adopted last year.
Treasure to return. The Vishakhapatnam Cabinet, the largest and most ornate piece of furniture of its kind in the Trust's collection, returns to Kingston Lacey in Dorset this June with an accompanying exhibition. The ivory inlaid cabinet, crafted from Padauk wood, was made in the Indian port city of Vishakhapatnam in around 1760. It blends Dutch and English furniture styles with Indian crafting and materials. Conservators at the Royal Oak Foundation Conservation Studio at Knowle in Kent have conserved it, gaining new understanding of historic Vishakhapatnam craftworking in the process. They also discovered a secret drawer which might have been used to store confidential letters or a diary.
And those were some highlights from the summer news. Our next feature is from the Director General. Your chance to hear from Hilary McGrady.
What is the use of living, if it be not to strive for noble causes and to make this muddled world a better place for those who will live in it after we are gone? These are the words of Winston Churchill, the former Prime Minister, whose legacy remains deeply important to the nation and to the National Trust, which cares for his home, Chartwell in Kent. They capture something simple and powerful that chimes with why so many of us are drawn to support the Trust, the joy and purpose to be found in giving. From the beginning, giving has defined the Trust. People have offered up their time, their voice, their donations, and their passion to protect nature, beauty, and history on behalf of the nation. The giving spirit has run from Octavia Hill's founding vision for the Trust's creation in 1895. Through individual gifts, such as Fanny Talbot's donation of Denis Olai in South Airy, Snowdonia, the same year. In collective efforts, such as Operation Neptune, which helped safeguard the UK's coastline for generations to come, and continues today with the ongoing support from our many members and volunteers, for which we are so grateful. As Director General in 2026, I want to offer more opportunities for people to find meaning and purpose in supporting our work, in ways that suit their lives and experience the joy that giving can bring. In January, the National Trust received the largest cash donation in our 131-year history. Philanthropist Humphrey Badcock pledged £10 million to help halt the decline of nature, tackle unequal access to nature, beauty and history, and inspire millions more people to care for the world around them. Of course, not everyone can give at that scale. But every contribution really does matter. Every penny spent in our shops, cafes and holiday cottages supports our work to protect places for everyone. And financial gifts are only one of the many ways to make a difference. Giving your time is just as powerful. Tens of thousands of volunteers support the Trust, carrying out extraordinary work every day. You can also give your voice. Joining the Trust and the chorus of other members and passionate supporters to raise the importance of protecting our nation's environment and heritage. For instance, on your behalf, we have recently spoken out against the anti-nature rhetoric in politics. Nature is not the enemy. The British public values nature deeply and wants to see it protected and restored, for our well-being and sense of place, but for our economy too. The joy of giving can begin much closer to home, through initiatives like the Sky Gardening Challenge, We're encouraging people in towns and cities to green their balconies. Programmes such as The Secret Garden, which features some of our members, also demonstrate how even the smallest gardens can make a difference. The joy of giving is not measured in scale, but in impact, and in the difference we can all make together. Thank you for being part of that shared endeavour and for helping to turn generosity into lasting change.
Thank you, Hilary McGrady, the Trust's Director General. Amid the twin crises of climate change and nature loss, it's easy to feel disheartened. Yet across the country, gardens offer patchworks of quiet but powerful resilience. Nurture them and reap the rewards for people and nature, says Sheila Das, the National Trust's Head of Gardens and Parks. And discover four trust gardens already adapting to tomorrow's challenges and thriving in the process. The feature is read by Akia Henry, Glenn McCready, and Tatia Newell.
We are a nation of gardeners. Whether we're tending our own plots, wandering through public gardens, or seeking green spaces in our cities, these cultivated places meet a deep human need to be close to nature. Around 41 million people in the UK gardened at least once a month in 2024, according to the most recent figures from the Royal Horticultural Society, RHS. Yet it's also widely reported that as a nation, we are more disconnected from the natural world than ever. That contradiction, our longing for nature combined with our distance from it, may be the very reason to explore how we garden and how through our gardens we might rekindle that bond with nature. Today's gardens face real pressure. Last year brought the driest spring in more than a century, followed by the hottest summer on record, with long dry spells and soil baked hard by the sun. These extremes were punctuated by sudden storms that highlighted how unstable our weather has become. The UK is also living through a nature crisis. We've seen long-term declines in insects, birds, amphibians, and wild plants, a pattern driven by habitat loss, pollution, and increasingly unstable weather. Gardens are some of the few spaces where many species can still find refuge. It's easy to feel overwhelmed that we can't make a difference, but our gardens might just hold the key. Some gardening habits that have become commonplace, such as artificial grass, synthetic feeds, pesticides, and water-hungry planting, no longer fit comfortably with the challenges ahead. As we learn more about the impacts of our modern lives on our natural environment, there is a growing awareness of the need for more nature-friendly gardening. The question now is whether we can see ourselves as part of the ecosystem and our gardens as places where real change begins. Given the severity of our environmental emergency, we should not be afraid to be bold. Now is the time to get creative and explore new approaches. It may feel daunting at first, but it's also an invitation to rediscover novelty, imagination, and joy in how we garden. At the Trust, this shift is already underway. Across the gardens in our care, we're refining a more sustainable, long-term approach that encourages resilient, healthy growth for the future. Instead of chasing quick results, we are making considered changes that bring nature along with us. That might mean choosing smaller plants that establish more strongly, or observing which creatures are using our gardens, or pausing between decisions to see what nature does next. We invite our visitors to learn with us, to notice small changes alongside us, and to celebrate the moments of quiet joy along the way. Balancing all of this with the responsibility of caring for historic landscapes isn't simple, but we are also custodians for the generations that will follow. At heart, gardeners are practical problem solvers who meet difficulties with creativity. Even the most difficult moments, like the dramatic storms of recent years, can open space for new life. We know that some historic practices are no longer sustainable, and we want to try to reduce the impact we have on the environment. So our first question is, do we need to intervene at all? And if we do, how can we act in ways that benefit people while reducing our dependence on mains water, protecting resources and increasing habitat rather than diminishing it. Because gardens, collectively, matter. Our public and domestic gardens cover about 4.6% of UK land. This may not sound vast, but when they're linked together, they can form powerful wildlife corridors. Healthy garden ecosystems can make a profound change to our environment too, regulating water flow, improving soil health, cooling and cleaning the air, as well as bringing more biodiversity into our lives again. And none of this means stepping back or letting our gardens look unloved. Quite the opposite. We can create clear cues to care. A crisp edge, a thoughtfully placed pathway, a beautifully arranged pile of fallen wood to show that we, the gardeners, remain present. Arcadia, a new forest garden at Shugborough in Staffordshire, has taken shape slowly over several years and is set to open fully later this year. The thoughtful design by Shugborough's senior gardener Lizzie Pellow was created to help people imagine the garden before a single spade touched the soil. Forest gardens are packed with diverse vegetation and habitats to encourage symbiotic relationships between plants, helping them to thrive and build resilience to the effects of a changing climate. Arcadia will be one of the largest gardens of its kind in the country and aims to encourage visitors to try their hand at forest gardening at home. Developing gardens for the future needs quality, sustainability, and community at its heart. We could call this slow gardening. If we embrace it, we might find ourselves at the start of a new era of gardening. How exciting to be part of it!
Adapt and thrive. Four trust gardens show how adapting for nature and climate can bring ecological benefits and boundless beauty.
Lindsay's vision reimagined. Clifden in Buckinghamshire. Clifden's historic 200-metre, 656-foot long garden was created in the 1930s by British designer Nora Lindsay for the Astor family. It features a long central pathway with Lindsay's characteristic thoughtful colour schemes and bold dynamic use of plants and topiary. But the team was becoming aware of how unsustainable the annual planting schemes were, as they required buying new plants each year, disturbing the soil frequently, and using a lot of water. In addition, the central grass pathway could not withstand the foot traffic, and the box hedging was suffering from box moth caterpillar damage and box blight. The team was therefore faced with a daunting task: how to reimagine the garden to make it more sustainable and improve access for visitors while honouring its historic legacy. Head gardener Anthony Mason says, "We spent a lot of time researching Nora Lindsay and thinking about how she might redesign the garden today. She liked to use colour and texture, and we've tried to honour her ethos in the new planting design." The team replaced the central pathway with smooth Yorkstone paving, planted the more resilient dwarf yew in place of the box hedge, and replaced the annual bedding plants with more sustainable perennials. Anthony says, "We put in over 6,000 perennials, which require far less water than annuals, and we used plants like hellebores to provide colour in the winter and swathes of ornamental grasses amongst the perennial planting. Grasses weren't available in Lindsay's day, but we think she'd have used them because they provide height and drama." Anthony and the team decided to use small plants to create the new scheme, which are far more sustainable than large ones. This required them to hold their nerve while the plants were getting established. Anthony says, "Some were only a couple of centimetres tall, so we had to be patient and let them develop. Within a couple of months, the smaller plants took off and wildlife exploded. We now see far more bees, butterflies, moths, hoverflies, and other insects in the garden. With the annuals replaced by perennials, soil disturbance is reduced and the soil ecosystem can thrive."
Anthony's top tip: make the swap to perennials. He says, "If you're thinking of switching some of your annuals for perennial plants, you might find inspiration at Clifden. Take time to walk slowly and see what plants and combinations appeal to you. Focus on a small patch you like and think about structure and textures. You can then translate that into a vision for your own garden and its conditions. Choose things you really fall in love with.
Making future history, Dufferin Gardens in the Vale of Glamorgan. Head gardener Chris Flynn says, during the pandemic, when Dufferin had to close to visitors, I sat by one of the ponds and watched a kingfisher. I had time to notice the amount of life in the garden and wonder how I might help more of it to thrive once visitors returned. The team spent the following 3 years recording everything that lived in the garden. They enlisted the help of bat, bee, and lichen specialists from all over the UK to help them identify what was hiding in plain sight. Chris says, before the survey, we had already returned a lot of our previously mown lawn to meadow, as it would have been historically. We believed it would have more value for nature this way, and the survey proved that it is even more significant for biodiversity than we realised. The survey results are shaping their work to restore the Edwardian Garden, a huge-scale project that will be another 10 to 15 years in the making. The meadow in particular is already helping adapt the garden for climate change, reducing the amount of reflected heat during the summer and capturing more rainwater over winter. Ponds, a historic feature, are playing their part for nature and climate adaptation too. The formal lily ponds support great crested newts and are full of dragonflies. The team plans to add ephemeral ponds, temporary wetlands that fill seasonally with water. As well as providing habitat for amphibians and invertebrates, the ponds will help the ground to hold more water. To the team's surprise, the survey showed how wildlife was using the more formal and traditional parts of the garden, as well as the more natural sections. Chris says, we discovered that some invertebrates and small mammals were visiting the manicured flower beds just as readily as other parts of the garden. Even in our most carefully tended bedding, we discovered rare brown-banded carder bees. It's encouraging news for Chris, who is aware that the garden is also putting on a show for the hundreds of thousands of people who visit each year to enjoy its flamboyant and opulent Edwardian planting. The plan, Chris says, is to make it as good as it can be while working more in harmony with nature.
Chris's top tip, take time to notice nature. He says, try to find out what wildlife you have in your outside space so that you can better look after it. A great way of doing this is to choose a flower, such as a daisy or a dandelion, and watch it for 10 minutes to see which insects visit. It's a technique we use here at Dufferin. Insects are at the bottom of the food pyramid, so if they're doing well, it's usually a good sign that everything else is too.
Counting every drop, Hidcote in Gloucestershire. Designed a little over a century ago by American horticulturalist Major Lawrence Johnston, Hidcote is celebrated as one of England's most influential arts and crafts-inspired gardens. Since it was formed, Hidcote has relied on a natural spring to feed its stream, pools, and in more recent years, three 36,000-litre storage tanks supplying the irrigation system. But in 2025, during the hottest summer on record, the spring ran critically low. The gardeners had never needed to monitor usage closely before, and although they planned to stop watering the larger lawns during droughts, the conditions raised urgent questions about water use across the entire garden. Head gardener Lottie Allen recalls, initially we used mains water to fill the gap, but once drought set in, we realised this wasn't sustainable long term. The team decided to halt supplementary watering and instead adapt to a dramatically reduced supply. The formal lawns along the central axis were left to turn brown. Pots and planters continued to receive water, but only sparingly, with moisture monitors ensuring not a drop was wasted. The drought finally broke in late August, but the need for a new long-term approach to water consumption was clear to Lottie. She says, we're trialling waterproof paints to line terracotta pots, adding sources wherever possible, installing more water butts and fitting a meter to the water tank so we know exactly how much we're using. During last year's drought, the team discovered that plants cope better in areas that have been mulched. This year, they are prioritising thicker mulches in key areas and using wood chip elsewhere to help slow moisture loss. Hidcote's gardeners are moving away from the annuals used by Johnston to fill gaps, instead opting for robust perennials able to tolerate prolonged dry spells. Lottie says, now we're preparing earlier, making decisions faster, and helping the garden adapt for the future.
Lottie's top tip, plan for resilience and resplendence. She says, finding plants able to cope with hot, dry summers and the UK's typical wet winters is proving difficult, but there are options to try. We found peonies did particularly well in the drought. Salvias, such as Salvia nemorosa cardona and Salvia royal bumble, coped well with the heat and then flowered later. Classics such as Lavangula and Gustifolia munsted enjoyed the heat but will only manage a wet winter where the soil drains well.
Inner Beauty, Nunnington Hall in North Yorkshire. Nunnington has been managed organically for almost 25 years, an unusual move back then, and one that senior gardener Nick Fraser helped pioneer. He recalls, "We had visitors asking if our lawnmower was broken because we had long grass in the orchard. We had to explain that we were creating wildflower meadows." Now, of course, it's much more common to come across areas of wildflowers in a historic garden, and in today's changing climate, Nunnington's soil is reaping the benefits of using organic techniques. All the things we've championed for years now, such as making compost and using it to mulch the surface of bare soil, means we have great soil structure that helps the garden stay resilient, says Nick. In times of drought, we have more moisture retention, and in very wet weather, that helps reduce flooding, which is an issue for us here on the banks of the River Rye. Alongside an overall better soil structure, Nunnington's team has made some changes to future-proof elements of the historic garden. They've recently reworked the iris garden, originally thought to have been designed in the 1920s by former owner Mrs. Fife, following a generous gift from the estate of trust supporter Mrs. Gertrude Mary Louis. The new garden's designer, Christina Claude, has come up with a modern, nature-friendly plan. It includes more seating, level access so wheelchair and pushchair users can enjoy the garden for the first time, and a new wildlife pond that's already attracting dragonflies and other insects. Nick says, "If we're not making gardens where people, plants, and nature can coexist, then I don't think we're gardening properly." In keeping with Nunnington's closed-loop ethos, in which nothing leaves the garden, the reworked iris garden has been made using as many materials as possible from its predecessor. This includes the Yorkshire stone paving, which has a new life as raised flower beds now awash with year-round interest. Nick says, "I think people are starting to look beyond the surface of a garden to see what has gone into making it, and are finding beauty is more than skin deep. Organic, nature-friendly, climate-resilient gardening. To me, that's all just gardening."
Nick's top tip, give organic a go. He says, "If you want to try gardening organically, try to be patient. Using bug sprays creates reliance because you lose your natural biological controls, so you think you have to keep spraying. When you stop, you might have to wait a year or two for balance to be restored. We get aphids on our roses, but the blue tits fledge as the aphid numbers peak, and within weeks, the birds have stripped most of them off." And you can discover more climate-resilient gardening tips and ways to boost wildlife at nationaltrust.org.uk/gardening-tips. Future-proofing our gardens isn't only about the planet, it's about people too. Our gardens must reflect our changing lives and needs, as garden designer Mark Lane explains. The feature is read by Tatia Newell.
26 years ago, I left behind a career in publishing and retrained as a garden designer. Having been a wheelchair user for as long now as I've been a garden designer, it's perhaps unsurprising that I've always created gardens with accessibility in mind. I've visited many gardens and landscapes, both public and private, and I'm always surprised to see how differently people design and use their spaces. Perhaps some will favour a more naturalistic approach, others a more formal garden. You can give several gardeners the same plants and the same hard landscaping materials, but when they've finished, every garden will look different. Before garden designers even consider cost, style, materials, and plants, we must always ask ourselves two questions. Does anyone who will use this space have a disability? And in the case of private homes, do you intend to stay here for the rest of your life? We don't know how our mobility might change in time, so it's important to future-proof gardens for any eventuality. There are other considerations. With the increasing unpredictability of the climate, gardens need to be designed and maintained with resilience, adaptability, and sustainability in mind. None of this has to come at the expense of accessibility. For example, when I'm designing a garden, I often choose to make paths and patios from permeable materials, such as resin-bound surfaces or permeable pavers. They'll reduce runoff and encourage groundwater recharge, supporting both the garden and its wider ecosystem. Similarly, I find opting for durable recycled materials for edging helps with long-term stability. It defines beds and walkways and reduces the risk of plant damage when you need to do maintenance. These hard landscaping elements also help wheelchair users and people with limited mobility to access all corners of the space. Permeable paving has a firm, non-slip surface and doesn't fatigue the eyes in the way that traditional solid surfaces can, especially when the sun bounces off them and creates a harsh glare. When I'm in a garden, I find changing levels can cause an issue with getting around. While steps or ramps enhance a design and perform that practical function of moving you up or down, they can also prove hazardous to those with limited mobility or vision. Try constructing step edges using a different colour or texture so visually impaired people can navigate the terrain more easily. You could introduce a warm-to-the-touch handrail, one made of wood or composite rather than metal, to make an accessible addition functional and pleasant for everyone. Go for lightweight, sustainably sourced outdoor chairs and tables on lockable wheels, allowing you to move them around easily and secure them once they're in place. While gardens have traditionally been shaped around grass lawns, a tapestry of rich flowering ground cover plants, a tapestry lawn, can be a great alternative for those with limited mobility. As well as helping restore ecosystems and providing food and habitat for pollinators, it also requires much less maintenance. A tapestry lawn needs just a couple of trims a year, as opposed to the weekly mowing required by labour-intensive grass lawns. I've noticed that lighting can be an easy fix to make a garden more accessible. Positioning it thoughtfully can help reduce light pollution, support nocturnal wildlife, and make it easier to navigate in the dark. If your lights are set too low, people in wheelchairs will be dazzled. If too high, they'll cast dark shadows, making it difficult for those who are visually impaired. Angled lighting or colour-changing bulbs can help offset these challenges. Rainwater is free and better than tap water for plants, so collect, store, and use it as much as you can. For those with reduced mobility, simple water butts with small pumps, some irrigation tubing, and a timer can help water your plants for you. If space is at a premium, consider storing water in underground water tanks. Link these to grey water outlets such as baths and showers, and you'll have an endless supply. With the changing climate, it's even more important for everyone to have places to sit and be in shade on a hot day. I always appreciate it when a designer has left space next to a bench for my chair, so I can sit shoulder to shoulder with a companion. And while benches with arms offer support to those lowering themselves from a standing position, they can make it difficult to transfer from a wheelchair. So, include a mix of both. Future-proofing a garden or outdoor space requires a holistic approach, thinking beyond the aesthetic of the moment to the long-term, ecological, practical, and social functions of the space. If you integrate resilient planting, sustainable materials, adaptable structures, and mindful maintenance, you can create spaces that are not only beautiful, but accessible and functional for generations to come.
From mystery anomalies to once-in-a-lifetime finds, Time Team archaeologist Giselle Kerai shares what it was really like to dig at Sutton Hoo in Suffolk during two remarkable seasons of excavation. It's read by Akia Henry.
The dawn chorus wakes me, along with anticipation for the day ahead. The sky lightens as I creep quietly along the creaky wooden floors of Tranmer House in the grounds of the Sutton Hoo Estate in Suffolk, trying to not wake my housemate. A cup of tea stealthily made, I sit in what was once Mrs. Edith Pretty's bedroom, looking out of the window. The fog is heavy, but I can just make out the large grassy lumps of the mystical Sutton Hoo burial mounds. Mrs. Pretty contemplated these mounds for many years before she finally hired local archaeologist Basil Brown to excavate them in 1938. The following year, he discovered a 27-metre or 89-foot long royal ship burial and countless Anglo-Saxon treasures, including the famous Sutton Hoo helmet, now displayed at the British Museum. The finds transformed our understanding of early medieval England. She probably sat in this spot, wondering what might be found by archaeologists that day. And here I am, nearly a century later, wondering the same thing. I dress optimistically for UK weather, with shorts and a layer of sun cream. I pull on my thick wool socks, my trusty digging boots, and, as a new member of the revitalised Time team, a logo-emblazoned top and jumper. Having ended its run on Channel 4 in 2014, the show was brought back on YouTube in 2022 by its creator, Tim Taylor, thanks to support from its fans on Patreon. I pack my sight bag with pencils and tape measures, grab a trowel, and walk out into the mist. I've worked at some incredible places, an 11,000-year-old peat bog site, the remains of Nissen huts that once housed the famous American paratroopers of the Band of Brothers, Neolithic barrows and quarries, but there's something unique about Sutton Hoo. It's why our team of volunteer diggers is made up of so many people who've troweled and studied this land's history for more than 30 years. Something pulls you in. I approach the large Time team tent for the regular morning meeting, and it's already a hive of activity. Dig director Justin is unlocking the fencing surrounding the trench. Time team director Emily is sorting through production paperwork, while archaeologist Helen Geek and detectorist Emma are chatting about the metal finds from the day before. Cameraman George is organising batteries, while archaeologists Angus Wainwright and Matt Williams are looking for finds bags and drinking a morning coffee, respectively. Collectively, it's a picture of calm anticipation that will build into a bustling day in the field. We all receive our locations and general dig assignments for the day from Justin and Emily, get prepped for any filming and pack any large tools we might need from the tent. I head down to Riverview Field. The team is split in two, with half of us working near the visitor centre and half in a field by the River Deben. This river is where the famous Sutton Hoo ships were rowed 1,400 years ago before they were brought to their final resting places. And it's in this field that a team of us would be spending the whole season searching for answers after a geophysical scan of the ground showed an unusual shape that resembled a boat hidden under the soil. The days fall into a steady rhythm. Breakfast, meeting, dig until lunch. Get carried away digging and forget to stop for lunch. Scrounge whatever scraps of food are left. Pop over to Sutton Hoo's National Trust Cafe for a chai steamer, where the till staff ask if we found anything yet. Dig some more, shower, dinner, debrief with dig mates, then get as much sleep as possible before doing it all over again the next day. It had been over 30 years since a research dig of this sort had been conducted at Sutton Hoo, and with 4 full weeks dedicated to the challenge in 2024, this was no normal time team dig, which usually takes place over just 3 days. Our team was made up of archaeologists from the National Trust, Time team and professional archaeology companies, alongside local volunteers, researchers and international Patreon supporters of Time team. Many of the core team had worked here in the 1980s and early 1990s under Martin Carver, one of the UK's leading archaeologists. Justin Garner-Lahir, who directed the 2024 and 2025 excavation, says, "I fell in love with field archaeology at Sutton Hoo when I first came in 1989, despite having worked in the field elsewhere. Archaeology hadn't gripped me quite like this until I first worked here. That grip tugs at me too. It's why I want to keep coming back, to keep finding answers about this mysterious burial ground." During that 2024 season, which ran through the entire month of June, the team conducted an intense metal detecting survey. We opened a trench to understand more about the cemetery that contained the Broomswell Bucket, a famous artefact discovered in 1986 when part of it was found impaled in the prongs of a farmer's cultivator. visitors can see those original finds up close, as they're on display in the High Hall at Sutton Hoo. Trust archaeologist Angus Wainwright explains, "The Broomswell bucket is a dull name for what would have been a glamorous object back in Anglo-Saxon times. It's a beautifully engraved brass vessel, made somewhere in modern Turkey in the 6th century, showing scantily clad hunters pursuing ferocious beasts like leopards. Round the top is an inscription in Greek indicating that it was intended as a gift, a luxury item for use in the Roman baths. How did it get to very distant Suffolk? A new theory suggests that it might have come with a returning mercenary who had been fighting for the Byzantine emperor. And to our delight, during our 2024 dig, the team discovered the rest of that bucket. Part of the side, as well as the base, along with cremated remains and a comb. Time Team's Anglo-Saxon expert, Helen Geek, enthuses over the beauty and history of the bucket, especially the side portion, which shows an image of a hunter. She says, "We found the missing man. It's the most extraordinary thing. We are the first few people to see this for about 1,500 years." By the end of the 2024 season, it is clear that the whole site deserves more attention, so we return in 2025. We quickly fall into familiar routines, many of the same faces reappearing from the previous year. Over the course of the season, the archaeologists turn up more finds right across the site. We extend the trench in Garden Field and add a second one near the visitor centre. We discover some intriguing finds, including a Roman brooch and a metal eagle relief cast in a mould. There are signs that the site is even more extensive than we thought, but there's still a lot to learn, particularly about the mysterious hump in Riverview Field, which still stubbornly holds secrets yet to be revealed. Together, the 2024 and 2025 seasons formed a uniquely public experience and something I have never witnessed before, an archaeology dig fully visible to the public. Clear fencing surrounded the dig throughout, with archaeologists answering questions and giving a behind-the-scenes view of a Time Team production. Angus says the National Trust has always wanted to support further research, but we also want to make the process of research excavation open for visitors to the site and those further afield to follow. At Riverview Field, visitors to Sutton Hoo would catch us mid-drawing or digging and call out questions. "I know you aren't supposed to say, but maybe you could tell us what you found?" they'd ask with a glint in their eye. We shared many laughs, and there was a palpable joy felt by everyone getting up close to archaeology, being able to peek behind the curtain and witness history being made for themselves. For the first time, I was sharing the job I love with visitors in real time. They could see that one artifact can break the time barrier of history and make you feel that connection to the past. Take a piece of pottery with a thumbprint on it. Who made it? Does your own thumb line up with theirs? And even as our trenches are backfilled, that sense of connection continues. This summer, as part of the Festival of Archaeology, visitors to Sutton Hoo can handle real finds during Finds Fridays. Try their hand at sand tray archaeology, watch Anglo-Saxon textile skills brought to life, or even play Anglo-Saxon war games with miniature model soldiers. Because that's the real magic of this place. Not just the treasures, but the people. The many hands and minds it takes to uncover the past. Different ages, backgrounds and physical abilities all doing work that goes far beyond troweling. At Sutton Hoo, visitors can experience something I've been saying for years. Anyone can be an archaeologist.
Find out more about this year's Festival of Archaeology at nationaltrust.org.uk/festival-of-archaeology. Would you like to join people in your local area for activities or days out? A National Trust supporter group could be just what you're looking for. The feature is written by Karen Gregory and read by Glenn McCready.
Although it's a wet and windy London evening, The weather hasn't stopped members of the Barnet National Trust Association from turning out in force. The church hall is bustling as people share greetings ahead of the evening's talk on Russian history. The speaker is really good, enthuses Jane Skinner, the group's secretary. I heard him present with our chair, Robert Lindley, at one of Enfield National Trust Association's recent talks, so I booked him for us. There's a good-humoured air of anticipation as people settle into their seats. Jane and Robert welcome the newest members, remind everyone about next week's lunch, and promise that details of the annual holiday, a highlight of the Barnet Group's social calendar, will soon be available. The speaker takes to the floor for an engaging romp through Russian history, from the Vikings to the Romanovs. Barnet Association is one of over 170 National Trust supporter groups across England, Wales and Northern Ireland, all run by local volunteers with a love for the Trust. They're made up of centres and associations, where people meet up for days out and activities. National Trust volunteer groups, which carry out hands-on conservation activities, and Friends of groups, which form a strong connection with a specific Trust place. During the break, the buzz in the room rises over tea, coffee and cake, quieting only while the raffle is called. The prizes, ranging from wine to books and bath oils, have been donated by the group, with funds raised going to support local Trust places. Talk turns to the reasons why people joined the Barnet Association. Robert was still working when he joined some years ago. He says, "I was still working in insurance, but once I'd fully retired, I joined the committee and was then asked to become chair. There's a real community feel to our group. People have common interests and are at similar stages in life." Most of this group are retired and value the friendship and activities on offer. Jane says, "Our members are all interesting people. Many of us have had pretty remarkable careers. One lady worked for the government during the war. She knows far more than she'll ever tell us. She had to sign the Official Secrets Act for life." In addition to monthly talks, the Barnet Association arranges lunches, coffee mornings, and days out to local places of historic interest. Some, but not all, in Trust care. Robert's favourites have been their trips to the London guilds or livery companies, some of which date back to the 12th century. They often visit them early in the year, when the weather is colder and wetter, because they're easy to get to on public transport. Robert says, "I really enjoy the outings. There are so many places you don't know about. Several of the places we go to only offer group visits, so we wouldn't be able to see them otherwise. We usually get a tour, and it's a lot more enjoyable when you go with other people. We often go on to get something to eat afterwards." The group goes further afield on twice-yearly coach trips and a hugely popular annual holiday. Robert says, "We often go to places it would be harder to get to on our own. I particularly enjoyed Knowl when we went to Kent. One of the archaeologists had given us a talk before we visited, which really added to our experience when we saw it for ourselves. You can do so much over 4 or 5 days, and when you get back, you feel like you've had a real break." Other group members also share their holiday highlights, which include a visit to Eme in the Peak District, made famous by the villagers' decision to isolate themselves during the plague. Jill Beverstock, the group's treasurer, has particularly fond memories of a visit to Lindisfarne in Northumberland. She recalls, "You go across the causeway at low tide, which is amazing. The island itself is quite large, with a very old priory and lots of little shops and cafes. We went to Bamborough Castle too. I've seen a lot of places I wouldn't have otherwise." The group donates the proceeds from their activities to support Trust places. Last year's donations include £1,000 for Knowl and another £1,000 to The Vine in Hampshire. "We have £4,500 earmarked for the Trust this year," says Robert. "We know every pound we raise gets put to good use." While some groups, like Barnet, raise funds for the Trust from their activities, others generously donate their time. The Merseyside National Trust environmental volunteers regularly spend their Sundays helping trust rangers across the north of England, including at Formby and Speke Hall near Liverpool and Dunham Massey near Manchester. They also come together for 2 weekends away each year, volunteering at trust places further from their base and staying in National Trust bunkhouses. National Trust life member John Huthnance has been with the Merseyside volunteer group since it was formed in the late 1980s. He joined because he found the fresh air and exercise a refreshing antidote to his office-based work. Over the years, he has helped with a variety of tasks, including clearing invasive species, tree planting, and laying and repairing footpaths. He says, "I find working on footpaths very satisfying because you see the results for a long time. They can look rather raw at first, but they have an amazing way of quickly melding into the background, and after a few months, they look as though they've always been there. We've done work to clear small trees to favour wetland and heather in lowland heath areas, and often leave cuttings in habitat piles for wildlife." The group consists of a mix of retired and working people, regularly joined by students doing the volunteering element of their Duke of Edinburgh's award. John says, "We all work well together, and I enjoy that social aspect of working in a group. We have a Christmas meal, and some people attend a regular walking group too." As at Barnet, many of the group speak of enjoying the chance to give something back to the Trust and to nature. John says, "It's my most tangible way of supporting the National Trust, which I'm very pleased to do because I believe in the Trust's work. I find the more you put in, the more you get out of it." The generous contributions of Merseyside and Barnet are matched by many other supporter groups who have collectively donated more than £25 million to the Trust since the first group was formed in 1948 in Manchester, as well as thousands of volunteer hours each year. National Trust Chair Renee Olivieri always enjoys the chance to meet them. He says, "I had the pleasure of speaking to one of our groups in Oxfordshire earlier this year and saw firsthand what these passionate and dedicated supporters do for heritage and nature. Our supporter groups offer opportunities to build strong local connections, enjoy visits to nearby historic places, and take part in engaging discussions on topics such as the importance of heritage. They also play a vital fundraising role for the Trust, support we are deeply grateful for, as it helps protect the much-cherished places in our care." Back in Barnet, the group is looking forward to a lunch next week. Part two of the Russian lecture is promised for later in the year, while other upcoming talks include the intriguingly named Memphis, Elvis and a Whole Lot More, and 60 Years in Showbiz. Jane says, "I really want to encourage anyone thinking about joining a supporter group to find out what's near you, and then just come along to a meeting and give it a go."
To find a local group near you, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/supporter-groups. Outdoor theatre has deep roots in British history. From medieval strolling players performing in bustling marketplaces and inn courtyards to the open-air playhouses of Shakespeare's day. This summer, you can continue the tradition as National Trust places across the country play host to a wide range of travelling theatre troupes. The feature is written by Emmy Tinkler.
Great for Shakespeare. In 1594, an unknown young actor and playwright by the name of William Shakespeare moved from Stratford-upon-Avon in Warwickshire to London to join the Lord Chamberlain's Men, a newly formed company of actors under the patronage of Henry Carey, Lord Chamberlain to Elizabeth I. Over the next 22 years, Shakespeare wrote about 38 plays for the company, and in the process transformed the art of theatre and the English language forever.
The Lord Chamberlain's Men, Othello. Today's iteration of the Lord Chamberlain's Men has been delighting audiences with performances of Shakespeare's works since 2004. This summer's production, taking place at several Trust places, is Othello. It's the tragic tale of a noble Moorish general in Venice who is manipulated by his ensign, Iago, into suspecting his wife, Desdemona, of infidelity. It's performed by an all-male troupe, as it would have been in Shakespeare's day. Expect bold storytelling with Elizabethan music, songs, and dance. The perfect summer's evening. For dates, places, and bookings, visit tlcm.co.uk.
Great for families. There's something special about seeing a play for the first time, especially out in the open air. If you're looking for something fun to do with little ones, these family-friendly performances are sure to fire young imaginations and bring classic stories to life with plenty of energy, music, and laughs.
Quantum Theatre, Treasure Island and Peter Rabbit. Quantum Theatre is back for another summer of theatrics with two family-friendly plays. Perhaps you'll join Long John Silver and his crew of salty old sea dogs as they weigh anchor across the UK, sharing the tale of Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. Expect sword fights, sea shanties, and plenty of swashbuckling action on the high seas. If you prefer your adventures on dry land, come along to meet Peter Rabbit and his cousin Benjamin Bunny. The naughty pair can't resist sneaking into Mr. McGregor's garden, where they find themselves in all sorts of scrapes. For dates, places, and booking, visit quantumtheatre.co.uk.
Great for Victorian wit. Theatre boomed in the Victorian era as industrialisation saw urban populations grow and freed up more leisure time for some working people. New genres flourished, offering everything from sensational melodramas and lively musical hall acts to problem plays. Pioneered by writers such as Henrik Ibsen, George Bernard Shaw, and Oscar Wilde, these plays use wit and realism to challenge the rigid conventions of Victorian society, transforming theatres into a venue for public debate.
Shaw's Corner in Hertfordshire. George Bernard Shaw, 1856 to 1950, was an Irish playwright and political activist who became one of the most famous men of his age. In 1906, he and his wife Charlotte moved to Shaw's Corner, where he wrote some of his best-known plays in a revolving writing hut that's still in the garden. This summer, Shaw's Corner hosts Rumpus Theatre Company for an open-air performance of his 1894 play Candida, a witty exploration of Victorian-era marriage, gender roles, and societal expectations. If you can't get enough Victorian satire, visit again in August to see Dot Productions' adaptation of Lady Windermere's Fan, written by Shaw's friend and fellow Dublin-born playwright Oscar Wilde. This comedy of manners explores themes of marriage, infidelity, and the hypocrisy of Victorian high society, with plenty of Wilde's famous biting wit. Candida is on the 24th and 25th of July, and Lady Windermere's Fan on the 22nd of August.
Great for a National Trust theatre. Many public theatres were built from the Regency era onwards, but it was also common for wealthy families to host private performances or to stage amateur productions at home. Jane Austen writes about one such incident in Mansfield Park, 1814, and at the Vine in Hampshire, there are books of children's plays that the Wigget Shute family used to stage performances with their names written beside their roles. Some families even built their own theatres at home, such as the Barn Theatre at Smallhithe Place in Kent. Smallhithe was once the home of Dame Ellen Terry, 1847 to 1928, who for more than 20 years was considered the preeminent Shakespearean actress in the UK. After Terry died, her daughter, Edie Craig, transformed the house into a museum to commemorate her mother's life and career and converted the historic barn into a theatre, which still hosts performances of Shakespeare's work each summer.
Theatre Royal, Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk. Did you know the Trust has a historic theatre in our care? Theatre Royal in Bury St Edmunds is the last working Regency-era playhouse in the UK outside of London. A group of local residents raised £37,000 to reopen the theatre in 1965 after it had spent 40 years as a brewery barrel store. The Trust took on the lease 10 years later. All kinds of performances have graced the stage since, and in 2005, a further restoration project reinstated some of the lost Regency features. The theatre is once again thriving, with this summer's highlights including the abridged works of Shakespeare, Jesus Christ Superstar, and a new musical about the 1960s pirate station Radio Caroline.
Great for a good laugh. Comedy and theatre have always gone hand in hand. From satire and slapstick in ancient Greek and Roman plays to the rise of Commedia dell'arte during the Italian Renaissance. Commedia dell'arte was characterised by largely improvised sketches and comedic stock characters, such as the know-it-all doctor and the mischievous servant Harlequin. These roots can be traced all the way through to modern improv, stand-up shows and comedy plays. Here are our top picks, if you're good for a giggle.
The Pantaloons, the almost complete history of Britain. Taking inspiration from Commedia dell'arte, clowning, stand-up comedy and silent movies, the Pantaloons form a vibrant and anarchic theatre company sure to have you rolling in the aisles. This summer, they're embarking on a race through the entire history of Britain in under 2 hours, complete with live music, audience interaction and wild historical inaccuracy. If you've ever wanted to see the life of Henry VIII told as a romantic comedy, or the tale of the Spanish Armada reimagined as a light operetta, this is the play for you. For dates, places and booking, visit thepantaloons.co.uk.
Great for the silver screen. Once the Lumiere brothers presented their projection of Moving Pictures to a paying audience in December 1895, it wasn't long before they and other budding cinematographers began mining theatres for good stories. Many of the earliest films were highly abridged versions of plays. Some were just key scenes, as was the case with the first film adaptation of a Shakespeare play, 1899's King John, produced to promote a forthcoming stage production at Her Majesty's Theatre in London. The films used to be restricted to cinemas, but now you can enjoy watching your favourite stars under the stars.
Adventure Cinema. Adventure Cinema visits some of the most picturesque locations across the UK, bringing an eclectic mix of classics, musicals, big blockbusters and family films to enjoy on the very big screen. This year's slate of films includes the likes of Pride and Prejudice, Star Wars and Dirty Dancing, plus sing-along versions of Grease, Wicked and The Greatest Showman, to name just a few. So gather your friends and family, pack a picnic, and get ready to enjoy a bit of movie magic.
Before we wrap up this edition, it's time to hear about some of the other events going on at National Trust places this summer. Booking is essential for many of these activities and some cost extra, so please make sure to check individual property websites or call the property for the latest information before you visit.
Stop and smell the roses. Summer brings vibrant displays of roses to gardens across the UK, filling historic borders and walled spaces with vibrant colour and sweet scents. At Mottisfont in Hampshire, the world-famous roses burst into bloom for just 3 or 4 weeks each year, filling the walled garden with fragrance and colour from more than 400 different varieties. The gardens stay open late on Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays between 21st of May and 13th of June, with live jazz on Thursdays.
The Victorian Flower Garden at Wentworth Castle Gardens in South Yorkshire has been restored to its former glory and even improved in places. New accessible paths make it easier for everyone to meander among the borders filled with new rose plantings, including special climate-resilient varieties.
The Dutch Garden at Spring Hill in County Londonderry is filled with more than 200 roses, which create colourful displays in the summer months. The four main rose beds contain 45 David Austin roses, while climbing and rambling roses cascade along the garden walls.
Visit nationaltrust.org.uk/rose-gardens for more rose gardens to enjoy.
Festival of Archaeology. The UK's annual celebration of archaeology returns from the 18th of July to the 2nd of August, organised by the Council for British Archaeology. Many trust places are hosting special events, exploring how we have shaped and been shaped by our environment.
At Attingham Park in Shropshire, from the 6th to the 19th of July, discover the finds uncovered during Attingham Unearthed 2025, a pioneering project that brought archaeologists, volunteers and local community groups together to uncover a Roman shrine, an industrial complex and traces of an Iron Age roundhouse.
Rainham Hall in London. On the 18th of July, delve into the history of the hall with a selection of items found under the floorboards, in nooks or dug up in the gardens. Dig for fake fossils or become a heritage detective uncovering the stories of this Georgian mansion. After, you can join a guided tour to see inside the hall.
Chedworth Roman Villa in Gloucestershire. On the 25th of July, join Dr. Martin Papworth for free guided tours of the villa and hear about the exciting discoveries he made here through years of excavation. Learn the stories of significant finds, such as a piece of glass from an ancient perfume bottle, fragments of rare marble that only the most influential in the empire could access, and discover the UK's only known 5th century mosaic, which has transformed what's known about the final years of Roman Britain.
Find festival events near you at nationaltrust.org.uk/festival-of-archaeology.
Summer of Play. Come out and play this summer with events and activities at more than 140 trust places across England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Get creative with arts and crafts, spend time in nature, try new sports and games, or put on a show. This year, Summer of Play is supported by Pokemon, with special offerings at selected sites including trails, sticker booklets and more. Visit nationaltrust.org.uk/summer-of-play.
This is just a small selection of the many things to enjoy at Trust Places this summer. For more ideas of how to make the most of the long summer days and evenings, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/what's-on. Well, that's all from us this summer issue. I hope you've enjoyed it, and do let us know what you think of this audio edition. You can email us at magazine@nationaltrust.org.uk. The National Trust Magazine Summer 2026 was presented by me, Sally Palmer. The readers in this edition were Akia Henry, Glenn McCready, and Tatia Newell. It was produced for National Trust Magazine by Sound Understanding, and all items are copyright. CDs of this audio edition are available to members of the National Trust who are blind or partially sighted and are distributed by the RNIB. If you know of anyone who is eligible and would like to receive them, please call the RNIB on 01733 375 370. Or you can write, enclosing the membership number, to Sales and Operations, RNIB, Northminster House, Northminster, Peterborough, PE1 1YN. This audio magazine is also available to download or stream as a podcast. You can access this and previous issues free of charge from wherever you usually get your podcasts. For more information, visit nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us for the next audio issue of National Trust Magazine.